The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
To go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
One
not because they are easy, but
we have main engine
hard.
Start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents. Consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners, and welcome to this very special edition of the Space Show. I'm going to forego most of the announcements because I want to spend as much time as possible talking with our guest today and focusing on a very important topic that Dr. Schmidt is going to bring to our attention and that we are going to discuss. But there are a couple of announcements that I must make. First of all, our toll-free number, if you want to give us a call, 1-866-687-7223. Remember, there are no call screeners, and let the phone ring until it can be answered. We'll bring you up on air just as quickly as possible. Email is drspace@thespaceshow.com, thespaceshow@gmail.com, and also dmlivings@yahoo.com. And then chat is on the AOL family, IM, ICQ, and CompuServe. The screen name is the same for all of those services, Space Show Chat. Okay, so the first really important announcement is that Microsoft is releasing Internet Explorer 8.0 today, and then it will be a forced automatic update next month. The Space Show website does not work on Internet 8.0. You cannot play archive programs on it. We do not know why. We're trying to figure it out. Microsoft is not being very helpful. Of the people that are helping me repair it, probably 60% of the websites that they're going to are not working on Internet 8.0. I would ask you not to download this web browser if you're a listener to Space Show programs until we can figure out what is required to make it work on 8.0. So it's available today, and I would just tell you to move with caution on that point. And then I do want to again reaffirm that the Space Show is brought to you in part by Secure World Foundation, which does promote cooperative solutions for space security. And you can get a lot more information about Secure World by visiting their website, secureworldfoundation.org. Okay, everything else I'm skipping because I want to introduce to everybody Dr. Harrison Schmidt, who is back with us on this Space Show program. He probably really needs no introduction because everybody knows he was on the moon on Apollo 17, the last group to go to the moon. But he has diverse experience as a geologist, pilot, astronaut, administrator, businessman, writer, and U.S. Senator. I'm going to put his full bio up on the webpage. In fact, it's already there right now, but again, it will be there for this program. And we want to spend our time talking with Dr. Schmidt, who has been very outspoken lately about government policies and what's going on in the field of climate science, global warming, climate change, all of that. Dr. Schmidt, welcome back to the Space Show. How are you today?
Great to be here, and good morning, good afternoon, good evening to all your listeners.
Thanks a lot. You were just at, I guess I'm going to call it the Contrarians conference in New York City, where the Czech president, who is a real scientist, led off with the keynote. Why don't you give us an introduction? I read your article that was in the Boston Globe, I guess, on what you think about climate control.
Everything that has been published is through the filter of some reporters, so there are both correct things and incorrect things in those articles, as everyone realizes the media is not well versed in this issue or many others, and often do not do their own research. But having said that, I think, except for a few dates being wrong in some of those articles that primarily came out of the AP, Associated Press, at least as far as they go, I think they give a fairly accurate position, picture of my view. With respect to the Heartland Institute's conference in New York, March, what was that, 8, 9, I think rather than the term contrarian, it was generally felt by the people there that they would like to be referred to as realists. And it brings to focus the primary difference between those that were presenting papers, scientists are presenting papers at that conference, and those that have basically decided that the science is settled and that climate change is human caused, at least in the modern era. The primary difference between the two groups is that one group is it consists of observers of nature, and the other consists of people who think they can model a complex system like nature, based primarily on one data from one station, and that is a 50-year record of increasing CO2 observed on Mauna Loa. In addition, that group of modelers have decided that political activities are an important part of their science. Now, whether that has to do with where they're getting their funding or their actual political beliefs or not, I can't tell you. I'm sure it's an individual case in each instance. But it is very clear that this is the primary difference between the group of two groups. One group are trying to realistically observe nature, and the other is trying to model nature. And a part of nature, namely the climate system, is extraordinarily complex, and most senior as well as many other people who are familiar with putting together mathematical models in order to gain insights into scientific questions believe that this is a fool's errand, that you just cannot model something as complex as climate, and in the process they are making assumptions that turn out to be wrong in many cases. And at the best, the proof of the pudding is that their models say that over the last, since 1979, since we've been observing the troposphere with satellites, that the troposphere should be getting warmer. Well, it's actually getting a little bit cooler over that period of time. And so they, just on the face of it, their models don't work.
What do they do with hard data that says troposphere getting cooler? How do they plug that into a model?
Right now they seem to be ignoring it. I can't speak from an up-to-date point of view of the modelers. It's not my field either, but I have not seen any reaction to that that fact that their models just don't work. They don't work because their assumption of a steadily rising CO2 level, one of the assumptions that they introduce with that is an increase in water vapor because it's in the models they assume that because CO2 is rising, that the surface of the Earth and the oceans in particular are getting warmer, and so they add water as a forcing element in the model, and that's in the troposphere, and that's probably why they're seeing in their models this warming that doesn't exist, because the troposphere hasn't changed that much in the last, since 1979, as far as we know, and probably for some significant period of time before that. The troposphere, by the way, there may be some people that, you know, the lower atmosphere, the troposphere, and the stratosphere are the primary divisions
of
the atmosphere around the Earth. If I seem a little bit hesitant here, I'm fighting an allergy, and I apologize for that.
What do you say to people? Here's a common thing that happens with me, because I'm pretty outspoken on the air as well as just in my private life against the man-made climate control arguments. And people who believe this and really don't have any other data other than what they've heard on the news or they've heard from their favorite politician, they say, what's the harm? If we make an error, we should be, you know, safe and conservative. So what's the harm in making sure we're protecting Earth?
Well, one is all the observed evidence is that you don't need to do anything, that there is no need to protect the Earth. The Earth is going to do what it's going to do. Nature will do what it's going to do. And for us to try to modify what nature's going to do at these kind of scales will be not only unsuccessful, but based on the policies that have been articulated recently, will be extraordinarily expensive with no results other than a reduction in economic growth, in higher energy costs for consumers, and in a further increase in the level of taxation of the American people and the people throughout the world that adopt that kind of a policy. That's the danger. And that danger is so great, I think, along with all the other financial policies that seem to be, in my estimation, misguided, that are going on today in the United States and to some degree elsewhere in the world, we are in danger of losing a significant portion of our liberty and a significant and with a significant threat to our national security.
You have a question from Dr. Jurist, who's in Billings, Montana. One of the leading anthropogenic global warming skeptics is Dr. Fred Singer. He has stated that he has paid a very high personal price in terms of personal attacks, insults, and irrational reactions by the media because of his advocacy of his positions. Have you encountered similar behavior? If so, how can the emotions be tempered down for a rational discussion?
I have not had any of those kinds of problems, but I'm well aware of Fred Singer's problems, and he has not been bashful about not fighting the accusations that have been made against him, and successfully, in at least in a couple instances in court. But I have not had that problem, and I think the realists in this, the observers, are being very rational. They're not yelling and screaming in the streets. And they're just trying to engage the modelers in a rational debate. It is basically the modelers and their political supporters that seem to be unwilling to enter into this debate on pure scientific ground.
Another question that has come in from you is Marshall in Dallas. And he says, I worked on one of the first computers that simulated world weather in 1973. A key input variable was the solar constant. Referencing an article in the science journal Nature from April of 07, Lori Fenton in NASA said Mars is now 0.5 of a degree centigrade warmer than in 1970. Space.com has from time to time used the phrase Jupiter's climate change. There was an article written about Pluto getting warmer. How do we separate natural solar warming from man-made warming, and does anybody really have a clue?
Well, they are separate. In fact, the observers can show you, and this was one of the more interesting papers at the Heartland Conference, that only about 4% of the CO2 in the atmosphere today comes from fossil fuel burning. That can be measured by looking at isotopic compositions and things like that. And also that it can be shown, and has been for many decades by geologists and others, that the lifetime of a new introduced molecule of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, on the average, is only 5 to 10 years. The IPCC, the UN panel that has been so active in this area, assumes that it's from 50 to 200 years, and they tend to bias it towards 200 years. And that's just wrong. We've known from atmospheric nuclear tests, looking at the isotopic changes over the many decades, that it is not that. There are scores of papers on this subject, and they all come to the same conclusion, that it's 5 to 10 years, and which means that they're interesting. Sidebar on that, that if you tried to double the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere within 5 to 10 years, that would all be in the oceans. You couldn't do it instantaneously anyway, because the oceans take at least 50 times more carbon dioxide into them than the atmosphere does. It is, you can see that by these kind of things how ludicrous some of the arguments are that we can somehow double the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. You just can't do it. The oceans are the primary driver of carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere.
You have this from Becky, who is in Manhattan Beach, California. And Becky says, I really don't understand a lot of this, and like many people, I'm just a normal college-educated citizen, and I'm being torn by what I hear. Advocates for man-made global warming all have PhDs in science. Many of them work for NASA, like Dr. Hansen. Others are also very bright, so it can't all be political agenda people guided by non-science or by something phony. There are real scientists involved in this. So how does one position themselves as a normal citizen to try to find out what's real or not real? Both sides seem to have very credible speakers.
Well, there's no question that they have credible speakers, but the thing, again, I'll go back to what I said earlier on, that the people who are advocates of human-caused global warming are computer modelers. They call themselves climate scientists, and I won't argue with that, but they're primarily people who use computers to try to model something as extraordinarily complex. We can get back to that in a moment. Whereas the real information that's out there comes from the other side, the observers, the realists. They're looking at what actually is happening in the climate, what has happened in the past, and trying to understand where nature is taking us in the future. Just as one example of what the observers know, from many different proxies, it is generally agreed by the observers that there has been a gradual half a degree per century warming since about 1660, the year 1660. And that was when the little ice age that affected both Europe and North America began to wane. That was the bottom of the Little Ice Age, and since that time, we've had an average, a very steady but a rise, but with many peaks and valleys along that rise, of about a half a degree per century. And that's about what we have been seeing in this century, since the Industrial Revolution began. That's a real fact. That's true. Yeah, there has been some warming. There have been warming episodes in our past. There was a period that ended about 1300, the year 1300, that is generally known and accepted by even most of the climate scientists as the medieval warm period. It was far warmer during that period of time, based on all the proxies that we can find, than it is today. And what we're worried about here. The other thing I'll go back to is that the modeling is all focused on the steady rise of CO2 on Mauna Loa. There are measurements being made elsewhere in the world that do not show that steady rise. And one of the big questions that the realists have is, we need to sit down and figure out why is the Mauna Loa record giving such a steady rise in CO2 in the atmosphere, and we don't see that in other measurements of CO2 over the last 50 years. We see a very irregular change in CO2. Now, we have tended to focus on carbon dioxide, CO2, but the primary greenhouse gas in our atmosphere is water. Water has a capacity 20 times, at least 20 times greater than carbon dioxide, to absorb heat and to keep it within the atmosphere. And the models do not understand water. They admit they cannot model clouds. They don't understand cloud formation in these models. And so just from that very thing, you begin to wonder not only why are they trying to do it, but two, you begin to understand why they've got it wrong, why they have they're predicting warming in the middle portion of the atmosphere, the troposphere, and it's not there. In fact, there's cooling.
You have a caller. Let's see what our caller is up to. And hello, are you there still?
Yes, I am.
And this is John in Montana. I recognize the voice.
Right. Jack, you've been pretty hard on the modelers, which is fine. I believe Johnny von Neumann once said something to the effect that give me four independent variables and I'll give you an elephant. And if
That's
you give
right.
me five, I'll make its trunk wag.
Freeman Dyson is very skeptical, too. Many of your listeners
right.
know who Freeman Dyson is.
Yeah, he's been on the show before, yes.
But why is there such a persistent and touching faith on modeling, not just with climate, but in so many different aspects of our life? There are people who have total faith in modeling our economy, which is at least as complex as the weather.
How well, they
and,
do that.
And it goes all the way down to simple models for crash reconstruction and everything else. If it comes out of a computer, people seem to think that the results are reliable, and the modelers don't seem to ever want to explain the weaknesses of their models or the scatter in the data or sensitivity to the input variables or any of those other factors. How do you deal with that if we are going to have any kind of a rational discussion or a rational debate about this or any other topic?
Well, John, I think you just keep trying, and you keep trying to make your case for observational fact wherever you can. The modelers are getting supported by the political class and being encouraged by the political class in their love affair with computers, and that's what it is. It's a love affair with computers. I'd like my computer too, but I'm not in love with it.
And, right.
But it is just something that is easier to do to sit in your laboratory, if you want to call it that, in your office, and do these models than it is to get out and collect real data. It's sort of the difference between field geologists and geochemists. I'm a field geologist, and I like to get out and collect real data. And the geochemists want us to bring the samples, and then they'll tell us what it all means. And often they're right, but they don't. The geochemists I know tend not to get involved in these very, very complex attempts to model nature, where you have so many more variables than you do equations to solve them. For example, the cell size of these models is generally, and they're all pretty much the same, they're all dealing with basically the same set of assumptions, so they tend to get the same results. The cell size is 250 kilometers square by a kilometer high. And in that size frame, they have to assume values for cloud formation, for thunderstorm activity, and all these things, because they're not observing it. They're assuming something for each one of those cells, and that is a very dangerous thing to do when you're trying to model a complex system.
And they're assuming that those cells are uniform or homogeneous as well.
Exactly, exactly, yeah.
Well, when all of this is pointed out to them, how do they respond and hold on to their theories?
Well, it's very difficult to point it out to them. That's the problem. It's very difficult to get a rational debate.
So, again,
it's politically driven because the financing is there to do this kind of thing. And when I say politically driven, there is the political class who are supporting this human-caused global warming. From a policy point of view, really do want more government control over our resources, over our incomes, and over our liberty, and that drives the whole process.
So that is the payoff right there.
That's for them. That's the payoff, and this is another way in which they can bring fear into the equation and try to get people to support a loss of liberty in order to some ephemeral kind of security, protection against human-caused global warming, which isn't happening anyway.
And our educational system is probably playing into that to a large extent.
Oh, very much so, and it has for decades. I 20 years ago, I did some work editing textbooks and science textbooks, and it was already being introduced even at that time. And the science tech, if you want, those people that have children, I strongly recommend you go look at the books and the media that they're being given, and you'll see what a high level of bias, political bias, exists even in the science textbooks. And that's being driven, by the way, the science textbook market is driven by what California wants. It used to be Texas, but now California. Really, that's where the publishers aim their publications, in California, and that's what the rest of the United States gets.
Harrison, my son went to UCSB in Santa Barbara, and I used to go down, and occasionally there would be oceanographers giving lectures to the public at a time when I was down there, and UCSB is known as an oceanography school, and I would go to these community-wide lectures, and they would talk about the changes in the ocean currents and what's happening and how global warming is adversely affecting the oceans and sea rises is coming up, and they're clueless as to any economic controls on an economy. They claim they're looking at the oceanographic science, and this is what they're concluding from whatever their scientific sources are. Where are they getting this information? How are they coming up with the opposite of what we're talking about today?
Well, some of those people are indeed observers, but they also have decided that what the conclusion is, and they look at their observations, which rarely exceed a decade or two, and they're assuming that what they're seeing is related, somehow supports their models, rather than looking at that these changes, particularly those that are solar-driven, what they call solar forcing, these operate not on decadal scales, but on century scales and multi-century scales. There are cycles within cycles within cycles, and these have been well documented now by people who have studied tree rings, people who have studied the deposition of stalagmites in caves. There are a wide variety of proxies for looking at solar cycles, and there's a very, very extensive modern literature, as well as an older historical literature on this subject. People have known that the sun is the primary driver of Earth climate for a very long time. We mentioned earlier the Little Ice Age in Europe. Little Ice Age coincides, based on, again, on these other observations, with three deep minima in the number of sunspots, in the level of solar activity over about a 500-year period. The last one was the deepest. It's known as the Maunder minimum, where there was observers, astronomers in Europe who were watching these things by that time, saw absolutely no sunspots during that time, almost no sunspots during I think it was about a 70-year period. And that was when the things were so extremely cold in Europe and North America. So you have to, all of the evidence, observational evidence for hundreds of years has been that the sun is the primary driver. The only, and many of the modelers will admit that. But because they don't know what the mechanism is for amplifying a small change in solar radiance on the Earth, or magnetic changes from the sun, then they discard it. They say, well, it can't be that today. It has to be fossil fuel burning. Those of us who think we're realists about it, saying it hasn't changed. You know, the sun is still driving this, and just because you don't yet understand what the mechanism is for amplifying a weak signal from the sun doesn't mean it isn't happening. And in fact, one of the papers, one of the very interesting papers at the Heartland Conference, was a gentleman who is using the oceans as a calorimeter. That is, he's measuring the heat of the oceans and its changes, and from that, from several independent ways of doing that, they all support the conclusion that you have a 5 to 7 times amplification effect just because the oceans are getting are gathering this heat on a cyclic basis relative to solar activity. Excuse me.
Well, so if you were to summarize what you've been saying and perhaps extend it a little bit, you have a situation where people who really don't understand the limits of modeling try to use the models inappropriately. They don't understand statistical reasoning or extrapolation of data under reasonable conditions. And then you have the politicians grabbing this for their own reasons and pouring money into supporting what's basically bogus science. Now, doesn't that corrupt the whole scientific process, especially if the public, who has rather declining literacy in terms of science and mathematics, takes whatever they hear most commonly as the truth? I mean, it seems to me that's just corrupting the scientific process totally.
Well, I tell you, I'm not going to say that the modelers don't understand modeling. They do. They understand exactly what they're doing and how they do it. They just believe that it is either on the one hand that the limitations of the models that they understand are not significant and that they are getting true results relative to human-caused global warming, or they have another agenda. And I tell you, it is when government funding began to drive science, and that was really during World War II, and then became particularly important in with the Apollo program. It began to corrupt science because everybody who wants to get grants from the government, whatever agency you're doing, will bias the writing of the grants to what they think the agency wants. That's human nature. That's natural. Well,
right.
Even in the last administration, agencies like the EPA and the NSF, the Department of Energy, NASA, were developing this bias towards a human-caused global warming. And so that bias has crept into what people are actually researching. And it can happen almost without people knowing it, but it's there.
Okay, so if the modelers know exactly what they're doing and understand the modeling and are doing this either because they have a misplaced faith in the accuracy of their modeling or the other agenda, then you have the same sort of thing that we've encountered in the alternative space movement, which is an unusual and almost undying faith on analysis as opposed to actually building something. And we see it all the time in the alt space movement.
Yeah, it's pervasive, and we've got to figure out ways, and that's a conversation many should have is how do you get alternative funding into science so that you don't so you can have a greater diversity in the biases. Everybody's going to have biases, but a greater diversity in biases that are driving research funding.
Can you lay that at the foot of indirect costs? Because most federal grants cover very large indirect costs, which is basically the Dean Slush Fund, and a lot of private entities will pay for direct research costs but are very reluctant to cover indirect costs.
Well,
so there's an institutional bias
that's certainly
in favor of government funding.
The problem. The problem, though, is that that you've got government driving research. And,
right.
If the government isn't funding it, not much of it's getting funded. And I also blame the business community overall, because they keep driving, and analysts, financial analysts and everything, they've been driving businesses towards looking at quarterly returns rather than long-term returns, and that tends to drive away corporate investment in research and development.
Right.
There are very few industries, we'll call them industries, that look far into the future, and that those are ones that only do that because they have to, like lumbering and pharmaceuticals. They cannot develop a new drug in over a quarter, and it takes years, and particularly with regulatory activity required for drug approval, and so they have to think very long term. But the financial world in general do not. They think in terms of what are the quarterly statements going to say.
I've got a question from Ted in Tucson, and I think the funding part you've already answered, but his is a two-part question. He says, I have a two-part question for you. First of all, I didn't see much in the media about the Heartland Conference you're talking about. Can you explain a little bit about what it was, and did the media cover it? I must have missed it. And also, I understand that you don't get NSF funding unless you represent the party line on anthropogenic global warming. Is this true? And you've probably already addressed the NSF part of it.
Well, it's true of most agencies that they are looking for a particular viewpoint on climate change, and proposals need to, whether they're relevant or not, proposals tend to have that, whether they're NASA or NSF or DOE, Department of Energy, they tend to force that bias on researchers, whether there is an actual relevance or not. Now, the Heartland Conference, it consisted of about 70 invited observers of nature to report in a whole bunch of different areas. And if people are interested, you can go to the just Google Heartland Institute, and very quickly you'll get to the website for that conference. All of the presentations are up on that conference. I'm not sure all the videos yet are accessible there. They're still working. They had a problem with some of the videos, including mine, in getting them so that people could download them. Whether that's been fixed or not, I don't know.
A conspiracy. But were you covered by CNN and Fox News and CBS?
No.
There were a few.
I think the New York Times had a relatively negative article. And I have not seen it. I heard about it, but there was not any media coverage there that I observed. There were a couple of film companies there who were producing documentaries, one from Canada and a couple others. But if you want more about the Heartland Conference, you're going to have to go to their webpage and seek it out.
Pretty amazing that the press would not cover this.
No, it isn't.
Okay, so standard operating procedure, the press only covers what is in its agenda?
Pretty much.
Charming. Doesn't say a healthy lot for our future, does it? Because it tells us we're all being steered and directed for the most part.
Well, it depends on, there are different sides of the media question. There is an alternative media, and you're part of it. And that is new. That is different. There is available much more information today over the internet than there used to be. And the major newspapers of the country, the major television outlets are feeling that pressure. They're losing readership and viewership. Things are changing now. Whether they're going to ever admit that they have to become more objective and actually cover news rather than opinion, only time will tell. The one of the difficulties, of course, is that there is a political bias in the media, and that is driving much of what they cover and how they cover it. The other difficulty is that the vast majority of Americans don't seek news anymore. They get their view of the world from entertainment programming. And that's probably a more dangerous situation than even the political bias of the media, because entertainment programming has clearly bought into the political agenda in many different ways, including that man is causing, humans are causing global warming. This all goes back to something that you raised earlier, and that is the question of the education system we have today. And I don't know that we want to get into that. That's a whole new subject and different subject. But in the United States, at least, the education system is broken. The public system is not educating. And in history or in science or technology or language or you name it, it just isn't doing it. For the most part, that doesn't mean there aren't some good schools, but overall, when when you look at the electorate and the kind of education several generations in the electorate today have gotten, they really do not have the tools to try to, by which they can evaluate these kind of questions.
We're going to take a break in a minute, but I'll tell you this quick story and listeners too. I'm an adjunct professor in space studies at the University of North Dakota, and I was there the first week of February to teach some classes. And
it was cold.
It was unbelievable, but they do have heaters in the building.
Stand by, we'll get rid of those.
Covered walkways from the Hilton over to the Space Studies building, so it's really not bad. You should actually come up there and do a colloquium with them. It would be, because I once brought up Fred Singer and his climate studies, and the next thing that happened was enormous attacks to assassinate the character of Fred Singer and not to deal with the issues at all.
Yeah.
So, anyway, we're sitting around at the table, and the students are there and the professors are there, and I mentioned Alexander Solzhenitsyn, and the students, many of them are in their 30s, look around, you know, this blank stare in their idea. Nobody knew who he was unless they were over 45 years old. I'm not kidding you. And then we go into the class that I'm teaching, and I asked for a show of hands. There are about 20 people in the classroom. Nobody, again, other than the professors who were over 40 or 45, knew who Solzhenitsyn was. I was stunned. And I turned around to the department head and I said, you know what? You need to teach a survey pop culture history class from the 19th, 20th, 21st century. Just one or two lines about who was famous and who did what. I mean, you can't be giving out graduate degrees to people who don't know who Alexander Solzhenitsyn was. I mean, this was stunning to me. I was shocked. So
probably would have had the same problem with the name Frank Borman.
Well, they may know him because of the space thing.
Well, I wonder.
Let's take a break. I've got more questions coming in for you, and we'll be back in about 2 minutes. So everybody stay right where you are.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to this special edition of The Space Show. Our guest today, Dr. Harrison Schmidt, and you have another caller with you. Caller, are you still there?
Hello there.
And who is this, please?
This is Lee in Sweden.
Oh, you're calling from Sweden.
I am, yes.
How are you doing,
Lee? How are you?
Do you have a question or comment for Dr. Schmidt? And welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I certainly do. First, can I say it's an absolute honor to speak to you, Dr. Schmidt. One of my heroes. I shall make this comment with the greatest respect. My point is, I sincerely hope that you are wrong about the whole climate change scenario, but can we risk it? Because if it is all down to man-made global warming, and we have the chance to put it right. Can we take the risk of doing nothing? And, you know, there's a lot of very educated people that have put forward the point that we're very close to a tipping point from which there may be no return.
Well, I the observations that I'm familiar with, and that significant number, do not support that, that there's any tipping point. The Earth is warmed and cooled because primarily because of solar inputs for throughout its long history, and the evidence is extremely strong that that's happened, and that there are feedbacks that prevent any kind of tipping point, with possibly a couple of with an exception that if we're interested we can talk about that go back into history at least four times. And it looks like in Earth's history there has been the Earth has gotten extremely cold. And there's starting to be some pretty good ideas about why that happened. But as of right now, there is, and for the foreseeable future, there's no tipping point on the horizon. If only because you can't keep dumping, you can't double the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. The oceans are going to soak it up. You'd have to probably burn all the fossil fuels available to you in the Earth in order to double carbon dioxide. The oceans soak it up in 5 to 10 years, and it's just not going to grow. And there's even a question, there are increasing questions about the validity of the Mauna Loa data over the last 50 years. Mauna Loa is a carbon dioxide emitter itself. It's a volcano, for crying out loud. And I think, personally, that there needs to be a very, very objective, hard look at that one set of data that is used to primarily to support the so-called human-caused global warming hypothesis. And then you also have to look at what are the consequences. Let's say that hypothetically that humans are contributing more than the 4% that we think they are, those of us who observe the climate, and we take drastic draconian action to restrict our use of fossil fuels, restrict our use of energy, to tax it, to take away the liberties of people to, related to that, those consequences may be far more serious, particularly to parts of the world, the so-called developing world or the undeveloped world, where their problems are not this. Their problems are much more personal and serious than this hypothetical look at what might be causing a half a degree increase in global temperature every century.
But surely if we set the wheels in motion to try and replace the fossil fuels, then that can also drive the economies. We just have to move from fossil fuel base to a different base.
Well, you can, yeah, you can do that, and that's where government can play a role, and others can play a role in doing the basic research necessary to find economically competitive alternatives. But if you force non-competitive alternatives into the economy at the wrong time, well, it's going to have the same effect. The cost of energy is going to go up. Taxes will go up in order to support the subsidies, and that that has its own consequences. We do not have right available other than nuclear fission energy. We do not have a readily available broad substitute for the use of fossil fuels for the production of electricity. We don't even have a broad scale substitute for the use of fossil fuels for transport. And now, can we develop those? Yeah, I'm a technologist. I certainly believe that the engineers I know and the engineers of the future are going to be able to do some amazing things, but it's not going to happen overnight, and it's going to take the research investment. If you try to introduce these non-competitive technologies too quickly, the unintended consequences are very serious, and I'll just give you one example, and that is this extraordinary subsidy being paid to develop ethanol from corn and to get it into the economy. That has raised food prices all over the world, and it is just wrong. It's the wrong thing to do, because the only way corn ethanol is competitive is with these huge subsidies. The same has same for wind. Wind is not competitive with any other way of producing electricity on a global scale or even a regional scale. It takes, and one of the primary reasons is there's no way to store the energy when the wind doesn't blow, except by having additional fossil fuel or nuclear power plants online in order to take up the slack when you cannot generate it with wind. So there are just any number of unintended consequences that are quite predictable at this point for prematurely introducing new technologies. Can we introduce them sometime in the future? I think so. In fact, I've written a book on the subject of getting fusion energy from the moon. I think those are all within the realm of possibility over the next several decades, but they're not here now. And to do it, and if we try to force the issue today, we're going to have tremendous difficulty in maintaining our standards of living and raising the standards of living of three-quarters of the world population that do not live like we do, and also to at a great cost to our liberty.
Well, I completely agree with you about the corn ethanol, but that was a real sort of major response. The government had to be seen to be doing something. The renewables, I mean, that's just basically an engineering problem. The storage.
I agree with you. I think it's an engineering problem, but it's a big problem to make them competitive with other energy sources. And until you do, however you force them on the society, you're going to have these kind of consequences that we already saw happen with corn ethanol.
But I think
you understand what I'm saying about wind. I mean, you cannot put wind farms in a particular region. You cannot introduce them at a level greater than about, at least in the United States, greater than about 10% of the base load capacity in that region, because when you go above that, you use up the ability of the baseload capacity to take generate power when the wind isn't blowing. So you have to build another baseload plant, and right now that baseload is either nuclear or coal. There are no other baseload plants to build.
Or hydroelectric.
Hydro's pretty well saturated right now. And I don't know what's happening in Sweden, but in America they're trying to close them all down.
The crux of my point really is, to be honest, I'm undecided about the whole climate change issue. I don't think we have enough data, but I'm so frightened for my children if it is correct.
We have an extraordinary amount of information. It's just that it's not being used by the modelers. I don't know whether they're afraid of it, they're afraid to find out that they've been wrong, or what? But
I've also read some very compelling reports about ice cores and the correlation between the CO2 in the atmosphere and the temperature changes going back over hundreds of thousands of years. And I know correlation isn't causation, but there's some pretty strong evidence there also.
There is good evidence and there's bad evidence. But the best ice cores, particularly those from Antarctica that have been stable for a long time, do show a correlation between temperature and carbon dioxide increases. And temperature increases and carbon dioxide increases. The problem is that the resolution of those cores is insufficient to tell you whether it was temperature that drove, that increased the production of carbon dioxide from the oceans, or whether carbon dioxide drove the temperature. The resolution is on the order of 500 years, and that's just not enough. And because there's other evidence that indicates that as you increase the global temperature average, as we have been since about 1660, you're going to with a lag, the oceans will begin, as they warm up, will begin to release carbon dioxide. That's the way gases work. That's basic physics. And this current rise, if there is indeed a true rise in carbon dioxide, And that needs to be verified, because we only have one data point at Mauna Loa. You can explain it by the gradual warming of the oceans. They're going to release carbon dioxide. So there is a lot of observational information. It's just that has not entered into the discussion, and the people of the world are not getting that kind of information. Now, also, you have to be very careful of these ice cores, going back to that, Because if the ice core has been exposed to any kind of dynamics, it's not a closed system anymore. And the information from it has to be evaluated, particularly that of gases, has to be evaluated very, very carefully. Indeed, there's another Antarctic core, the so-called Stipple core, that indicates that with time, the ice has equilibrated, and you have essentially a constant carbon dioxide content in the ice with time. Now, that almost certainly was not a closed system, because we know carbon dioxide has been varying historically in the period of time that's covered by that core. So it's not an easy subject, but there is a great deal of observational information that, if it was available to and understood by the public, they would begin to see that nature is controlling what we're seeing and not the human beings. That, again, I go back to this fundamental observation that only about 4% of the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere today comes from fossil fuels. That is an observational fact.
Well, I suppose the one point that we can definitely agree on is more research and better data needed.
Oh, yes, and I'm a great supporter. I think getting more observational data from space, since this is a space show, is a very important part of this. The fact that the satellites have been using microwave sounding to determine temperatures in the troposphere since about 1979, show a slight cooling in the troposphere, where the models show a significant warming. I think that's extremely important, and it also puts to question the validity of any of the models that they have today. And I'm not saying that I really think you can model this this very, very complex system. One of the things that you do not appear, as near as I can tell, in the models is what is the effect of what's called the global electrical circuit. And that is a major factor in how weather patterns, weather develops and things like that, is this integration of the ionosphere with the surface of the Earth, and then finally the circuits completed by lightning strikes throughout the world. And I would be almost willing to bet you that the modelers do not take that into account today.
It's a shame that, what was the name of the probe that was going up that crashed a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, yeah, that was, and I have a very personal connection there, because a company I'm a director of built the satellite and launched the rocket.
Oh, dear.
We're extremely disappointed that somehow or another the shroud did not deploy as it was supposed to.
Well, I shall keep my fingers crossed that you get a chunk of that money that's floating around the government at the moment to build another
very
one.
Very seriously considering... I don't know that they've made a decision. I would not be privy to it if they had, but seriously considering building a duplicate of that carbon measuring satellite.
Well, I'm going to free up the line now, but it's been a pleasure talking to you, Dr. Schmidt and Dr. Livingston.
Thanks a lot, Lee.
And I'll speak to you again soon.
Okay.
Dr. Lee.
Harrison... when the ice cores show the increase of CO2 and the increase of temperature, it's important to note that man wasn't blowing CO2 into the atmosphere way back when.
Oh, yeah.
So we're talking about natural increases in CO2.
Yeah.
You've got a couple of more, in fact, a lot of listener questions. This is from Dr. Rowe. Very short question. Since we're discussing modeling, how reliable do you think a 6-degree head-down tilt study and bed rest study is in simulating microgravity?
Well, the human body is certainly as complex as the climate system, and probably more complex. And I'm always very suspicious of modeling the human response to space. You can learn some things from those kinds of experiments, particularly if they're done over longer periods of time. But you need a lot more information, I think, and particularly realistic spaceflight information in a controlled way, a controlled physiological way with controlled protocols, in order to be absolutely sure what's going to happen to with a human adaptive response to spaceflight.
Question from Marshall again. One of the biggest holes in weather simulation is a lack of weather data over the oceans. Data over land seems reasonably good. How many years have we had adequate data for the weather over the Pacific Ocean, for example? What is the required data accuracy for good climate predictions?
Well, you're getting into technical areas that I'm not going to try to come up with some numbers for. But I would say, though, that the listener is right that we do not have a good global coverage of all of the climate information you would want to have over the oceans, and particularly over a long period of time. And even on the land, we have seen rural temperature monitoring stations shut down in recent decades rather than proliferating. And so more and more, the temperature data you're getting are from non-rural areas where the heat island effect still has to be taken care of and taken out of the data. And there are real questions of whether it is being taken out of the data properly or not. And there have been a number of papers recently in Science Magazine and I believe also Nature that have caused, brought into question the nature of the measurement of sea surface temperature. Much of that data comes from ships crossing the oceans, and it appears that there was a significant bias in some of that data. It doesn't mean that they haven't figured out what that bias was, but it is very, very difficult to get a systematic measurement of global temperature. And that's just another factor that has to be taken into account in these models, is that our knowledge of global temperature is not very good. We're probably much more knowledgeable about what has happened in the past because we have surrogates for global temperature in plant life and other things like that, fossil plant life. But we really don't have a good way to get a comprehensive measure of global climate in what we call, used to call the space program, real time. And that's where satellites will be extremely valuable to us and have been already, as we've discussed previously.
Okay, let me get to some more questions. This is a comment from Carolyn in Salt Lake City. Earlier in the show, you mentioned most Americans get their news from entertainment. Therefore, we need to see you go head-to-head with Jon Stewart on The Daily Show. When is it going to happen?
I doubt if I'll ever be invited to do that.
He's a hard one to go head-to-head with, but you'd be a great guest, let me tell you. And he really has the agenda big time, so it might happen. Okay, Terry is asking for clarification. He's also in Texas, and he says, so man, with his melting, is not really changing the global climate, but is man changing the local climate and atmospheric conditions by concentration? Is that a fair understanding?
Well, I'm not sure what he meant by melting. If he's talking about the media spectaculars of watching...
Meddling.
Meddling.
Yeah, meddling.
Well, I don't know. Human beings are part of nature, and I don't consider overall civilization as meddling in nature. We are participating in it, and to some degree, at least in, by the building of cities and farming and mining and things like that, we are modifying nature. There's no question about that. And if it's not done well and not done properly and not understood, it can have adverse consequences. But those really are localized compared to the globe as a whole. And to the realist present at the Heartland Conference and others around them do not see that the globe is being affected by these kinds of activities. Certainly local areas, particularly urban areas, and indeed agricultural areas are being affected. You know, China's been growing rice all throughout very, very large areas of China for thousands of years, and We have been growing crops in America now for a couple hundred years on a very large scale. So, yeah, there are going to be modifications of nature, and the question, we're now getting smart enough, scientifically at least, and technologically, that we can begin to mitigate the adverse effects of human activities that, at least on a regional scale, are affecting the quality of life. And I think, and certainly in the United States, that has really been a remarkable effort over the last several decades. Rivers now are clear where they were not clear before. We're learning how to reclaim mining lands and the like. There really has been a lot of progress in this area, and I'm sure there will continue to be more.
Marshall in Dallas has given up the instant messenger for the telephone, so welcome, Marshall. How are you?
Hello, how are you?
Your question or comment for Dr. Schmidt.
I basically have always held that methane is as much of a problem as CO2, but let's assume that CO2 and methane are real planet killers. Why are the environmentalists not pushing for one of the two 100% green power sources that could power the world for centuries? And that's basically space solar power and helium fusion. My personal feeling is they're my solution only bigots, but hey, that's one of the problems.
So what do you think of space solar power, and obviously we know your thoughts on fusion.
Well, space solar power is something that I've been involved with indirectly and directly for many decades, and it is one of those things that where you need an apples to apples comparison between that potential energy source, helium-3 from the moon, as a fusion fuel, and the existing fission power and coal power that we have today. The marketplace, if it's allowed to function, will ultimately decide what are the best and most economical energy sources. My own personal feeling is we're going to need them all, and that engineers and scientists need to move forward to try to, and investors need to move forward to try to explore whether or not some of these more exotic energy systems can indeed be economical in the long term. My concern about satellite solar power is that it's not really investor-friendly. I think the helium-3 lunar thing, as the case I've made in my book, is investor-friendly, but because there's so many spinoffs on the path towards actually getting business spinoffs on the path towards actually getting power out of lunar helium-3, that does not seem to exist nearly as well for space solar power. But again, I have not studied it at the level of detail that I have helium-3, mainly because it looked like the less obvious competitive power source for the future to me, and so I concentrated on helium-3. If I have time, I'll try to do a similar study for space solar power.
Pete,
it doesn't look quite as encouraging to me as helium-3 does.
Well, I was actually using this to lead into the question, which you kind of touched on already, is the fact that there's a lot of synergy between the two. If you're up there mining helium-3, you're going to be making the raw materials to produce a massive number of space solar power stations and basically start lifting the material off the moon instead of trying to lift it off of Earth, which, if my memory serves me correct, was basically one of the weak points of the 1976 through 1979 proposals for putting up a prototype and kind of proving it out, which is basically John Mankin's issue today.
Yeah, Dave Criswell has done a lot of great work in looking at the lunar supplied power systems, and particularly he's looked at actually having the power generated on the moon. And you're right that it, once you are established there with a settlement and an economically competitive fusion power or fusion fuel production system, then the possibility is that you can morph some of that activity into building the kind of solar power systems that Dave Criswell has been advocating. That's a real possibility. I'm not sure that you can bootstrap lunar solar power by itself without a great deal of government funding. And I just don't see investors are going to be nearly as friendly to that as they might be to lunar helium-3.
Just need another stimulus bill, that's all.
I agree.
Well, they're spending far more money than we would need in order
fall.
To get started on the moon, that's for sure.
Well, absolutely. Wouldn't it be nice if part of the stimulus really did do economic development?
Well, I don't
know.
I tell you, once you get the government in your pockets, as the banks are starting to figure out,
give the money
it
back.
Makes everything more expensive and more difficult.
Absolutely.
Thank you for your time, and I'll let somebody else have a crack.
Thanks, Marshall.
Bye.
You know, Pete Warden will be on the show Monday, listeners, to discuss the business case of space solar power, which is not economic friendly. You'll definitely want to hear that, and we'll ask him about this investment opportunity that NASA Ames is helping to fund on some bio kind of energy creation and what's happening with it and how bullish he is on it. And it's actually located in the Bay Area near Ames, and I don't remember the name of it or I would tell you. But I will ask Pete to talk about that on Monday. John has a question. It's actually a comment, and I'll ask you about it. Astropolitics has a reviewed article in the coming issue, which I guess is coming in April or in May, that the upper atmosphere ozone pollution from rocket exhaust is a showstopper, and it's an increase in the order of 100 times current launch rates, and brings effects similar to those of metered-dose inhalers, which are being taken off the market pretty quickly by the FDA, not just in the United States, but in other nations as well. Do you know anything about massive rocket launches and what it would be doing to the upper atmosphere and ozone?
I don't. I do know that there have been some recent questions about whether the chemistry assumptions that drove the Montreal Protocol were correct or not. And I also know that we just haven't been looking at the ozone system for very long. Satellites just haven't been operating for more than two or three decades that give us that kind of information. So we don't know what its natural variability is. So again, modeling what the impact of rocket launches through the stratosphere might be is going to be a very difficult thing to do. Now, at least for the helium-3 case, the number of launches is not great once you're established on the moon. And bringing helium-3 back, of course, is almost a no-brainer because you're bringing small amounts of material into a very large gravity well. Since the energy content of helium-3 is so high, it is one of those issues that I'm sure will be people will be forced to do the best they can in predicting what the effect of rocket launches is going to be. That's just the way the modern world works. You do your environmental impact statements and try to convince people that you know enough about it to not do any harm. I tend to have the observationalist bias that the sun is going to be your primary controller of ozone in the atmosphere and probably not what human beings are doing.
Well, I'm working on getting these authors on the show, so hopefully that'll be a good discussion, and I'll ask them about the modeling. In our remaining time, can I ask you about your letter on going to the moon versus Mars and the Planetary Society that was made public a couple of months ago. You really think we should be focusing on and heading back to the moon, and that should absolutely be the priority, correct?
Yes, it's the fastest way to get to Mars because you are doing everything that you need to do as a precursor to learning how to get to Mars as well as how to work there. by going to the moon, and at the same time, you're gaining a great deal of new scientific information, you're gaining a great deal of operational experience, and you're with the moon, with being well established on the moon, you open up these opportunities for new energy sources, whether they be helium-3 or solar from the moon. It's just the advantages of doing it in a stepwise process, or moon and then Mars, I think, vastly overwhelmed trying to put together without that a Mars expedition. You need rockets of the comparable size in order to build your Mars spacecraft in Earth orbit before leaving. You also can use the moon as a source of consumables for the Mars mission and reduce by a great deal the amount of weight that has to be and the cost of taking that weight into Earth orbit for initiating a Mars mission. So the moon just makes a lot of sense in many different ways as the best first step on the way to Mars. Those of us who advocate going to the moon first really do have our eyes on Mars, and anybody who says otherwise is just wrong. That's where we want to go. There's no question about it. But we think the fastest way to get there is by going to the moon first.
Do you have any ideas if in this economy and our new administration, whoever comes in for NASA, is going to continue the effort to go to the moon, or what's your best guess on that?
I have no guess. I have no idea. This administration has turned out to be a bit squirrely, and I'm not going to try to predict what they're going to do with respect to space.
Don,
the mere fact that they had such a low interest in it and that they have not selected a new administrator is a telling point.
Donna in Seattle says, do you think we can afford to go to the moon in this economy?
The level of NASA's budget that now about $18 billion a year is only a very relatively small part of that, less than I think about a third of that, is really focused right now on the Bush initiative to return to the moon. When you see the kind of dollars that are being thrown around at projects and things in the trillions now that have much less to do with the future of the United States than the space program does, we certainly can afford it.
Well, the whole NASA budget is less than 1% of the. Actually, probably now it's probably
it's
less than
1%.
Yeah. Given that we have a new budget, right?
But percentages I don't like percentages. I mean, you got to look at what the taxpayer actually is going to pay. The taxpayer doesn't pay relative. They don't look at the percentage. They look at what comes out of their pocket. And space gives a tremendous bang for the buck. For the taxpayer. Now, on the other hand, I would not have the government do the kind of things that I've been advocating, such as developing helium-3 fusion and helium-3 production on the moon. I would rather see investors do, because that's the fastest and most economical way to get it done.
Well, the government has spent billions into fusion, and we're not there yet, and there's a bunch of private people doing Dr. Bussard's and other, ideas for alternative fusion. Why is fusion so hard? Why is it defying our getting to engineering break-even?
Well, the government's made it hard. They turned some very fruitful physics experiments that teach us a lot about plasma physics into an attempt to build a fusion reactor with the idea that somehow it's going to become commercial using a non-starter as a fusion, what we call a fusion cycle, namely deuterium-tritium fusion. Deuterium-tritium has so many problems with it forever becoming commercial that I just don't see it happening. First of all, it is very capital intensive, you need these huge magnets to control the plasmas. And tremendously large power plants to ever get to break even and to sustain break even, a long way from that. And even if you were successful in all of that, about every 3 years you have to shut down these DT fusion, deuterium-tritium fusion reactors, and take out the first wall because it's been destroyed by the 14 MeV neutrons that are impinging on it and have to impinge and go through it in order to extract the heat to drive turbines. And that material, that first wall material, when you pull it out, is high-level nuclear waste, so you have to dispose of that. And it can't be reprocessed. And in addition, tritium is a radioactive fuel. So there are just all sorts of problems with DT fusion. I think it's great science, but it's never going to become a commercial reactor, and that's why those of us at the University of Wisconsin and the Bouchard people and to some degree the Japanese have been looking at electrostatic confinement systems, which are much less expensive. They're amenable to helium-3 fusion, which produces proton as its primary reaction product, and therefore no waste is going to be produced as a result, no high-level waste, and no waste at all if you go helium-3 fusion. And also, you don't have to go through a turbine system to generate power. You can convert protons directly to electricity. So there are all sorts of commercial advantages to doing the helium-3 route rather than what DOE and the rest of the world have been working on. It's sad that we're spending all these billions of dollars without really understanding why we're spending it. We're spending it on a physics experiment. We're not spending it on development of commercial fusion.
Do you see any change in that coming up in the future in the way
No, DOE is committed.
DOE.
The only way any other alternative fusion systems are going to develop is if the private sector does it.
Alan in Austin, Texas, sent in an email, and he said, given that you're a New Mexico resident, are you a supporter of Spaceport America?
You know, that's another. I'm a fairly conservative guy, as people probably have already recognized, and I personally think New Mexico is a great place to have a spaceport. In fact, it was a runner-up to the Cape for Apollo, and the primary reason I think that it did not make the cut, the final cut, was that there was no transportation system for these huge rockets, and you'd have to build that in here, whereas you could barge the rockets to the Cape from Louisiana when you constructed them. But otherwise, it would be a great place. The White Sands Missile Range is high altitude, great climate, and a good place to have a spaceport. If it's so good, though, then the people who want to use it for commercial purposes should pay for it. I don't think the New Mexico taxpayer should pay for it.
And they are paying for it.
They are paying for it.
And will be paying for it for quite a while to come.
Yes, sir.
You have another caller. And, caller, are you still with us?
Yes, I am, Dave. It's Dave Huntsman.
Hi, how you doing, Dave?
Okay, hey, I know you only got a short period here, but Jack, if it's okay, I'd like to go back to fusion just for a moment.
Sure.
I don't know if you saw Secretary Chu's testimony before Congress 2 days ago. But,
no, I didn't.
It was a kind of wonder to, I didn't see the full testimony, I read a statement, and it was very nice to behold because he emphasized transformational technologies, and most important to me, he is going to promise to set up ARPA-E as fast as possible and actually get it funded. It's currently authorized at $300 million for the current year, even though I think you both know it never really got funded after it got established. So that was all good to hear. But don't you think that ARPA-E would be a good place to push for at least a segment of that to look at demonstrating a couple of these alternative fusion technologies, whether it be the one of the aneutronic fusion types or even the laser one out at the lab, and see which one of those might actually have some promise. I mean, there's a potential home for it now.
Well, I'm sure my colleagues at the University of Wisconsin and probably elsewhere are going to be, maybe Illinois, which has a small group as well, that they will be looking at ARPA-E and seeing and testing the waters there and seeing if there's any inclination for a DOE-sponsored innovation group to look at alternative fuels. Right now, though, DOE is so firmly committed to the ITER project in Europe that they have cut essentially all funding, internal funding for and external funding for alternative systems. And RPE is going to have to reverse that if they're going to start to do it. And they're going to be I think paddling upstream on that kind of reversal because of the of this commitment, the long time commitment in DOE and in the physics community, the experimental physics community, to ITER. And they'll be worried about anything showing up that might look a little bit better.
Dave, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still there. I guess I'm a little bit more hopeful that there's a chance on that. The reason being, I went back and looked at the founding legislation for RPE, and it, by legislation, is not allowed to be integrated with the rest of DOE. Its head is to be direct selected solely by the secretary and report solely to him. And, you know, we've got a real researcher at the top there, and he understands looking at alternates.
Yeah, if you believe it's going to be independent, then I got a bridge to sell you.
Well,
I know Washington, and it won't be. And Chu has his own agenda, and he's particularly a global warming, a human-caused global warming person. And he his idea of alternatives, I think, are going to be the so-called renewable alternatives. And not fusion.
Maybe
not fusion other than ITER. I think ITER will get its support.
Maybe you can sell him a spaceport, okay?
We'll see. I don't know. I'll give him the benefit of the doubt until I see what actually happens.
Well, I guess my last word, Jack, is, you know, I would write an op-ed to the New York Times myself and try to say that part of ARPA should be set aside for that and laying out the case to at least get it out in the open, except that I can submit an op-ed to the New York Times and it wouldn't get published.
Mine won't either.
You could submit one and it might.
I don't think so.
All right. I just wanted to put the bug in your brain. I'll even draft it for you and send it to you if you want. just keep it in mind.
I have not had much luck with the York Times.
All right. Well, I'm volunteering to help, Jack.
Thank you.
Thanks, David. Right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Probably one last question from Marshall, and he says, do you think ITER is ultimately going to fail?
Well, it may not fail as a physics experiment, but it's going to fail as a demonstration of a commercially viable fusion power system. It's a long way from ever doing that.
Absolutely. As we come up on the end of the program, what would you like to leave us with? What would be your concluding comments, or you know, how would you like to leave the show today?
Well, I hope that your audience will increasingly ask questions about what we actually observe in nature, and what is it telling us about the question of whether or not human beings are causing global climate change. And they need to question their politicians as well as scientists that they run into, and why the observational information that we know that shows that the sun has always been a major driver in climate change, why that has suddenly changed, and ask them what do they know and what data they have about the amount of fossil fuel produce carbon dioxide that actually is in the atmosphere. And if they're honest with them, they'll say, well, there's not much yet.
For parents who have kids in public school or maybe private school and middle school science, high school science, and they're getting the fait accompli for anthropogenic global warming, what would you suggest to parents so kids can get exposed to a different credible perspective?
Well, this Heartland Conference website is a good source of new information, and parents should go there and look at it and see how much observational data there is that the human component is extraordinarily small. And it is not significant compared to the natural components.
So a good place for parents to introduce
it. It's a good resource right now. Now, it's going to take some work because the people who gave the papers are all top-quality scientists, and they thought they were talking to top-quality scientists. But there are a few that really do speak to the general public, and one of the best is Robert Carter, Bob Carter, who is an Australian, and he just does a super job. And his talk, I think it was on the luncheon, probably a luncheon talk on the second day. But anyway, just look for Bob Carter's talk. It's videoed, and you can learn an awful lot from that talk.
You got another call. Will you stay to take it?
Sure, and then I'm going to have to run.
Okay. Caller, real quick, you are?
Andrew in Tucson calling for Dr. Schmidt.
Okay, you got real quick because he needs to get going.
You betcha. I was wondering, you know, both sides on this fight on global warming have taken shots at silencing the other. It's been kind of shocking for me to actually see this. I was wondering, since you've got so much more history in the scientific community than I do, if you could compare this to your experiences with controversy from your age might have been more the impact versus volcanic theory of craters on the moon. And I'll just take it from here.
Well, I'm not sure what you've seen, Andrew, about certainly the human-caused global warming group, the modelers, have tried to dismiss and have been unwilling to really debate the realists, the people observing nature. But I don't think the other side has tried to do that at all. In fact, they get invited to conferences, don't come, but they get invited. I think it's been a one-way street on the attempts to silence one group or the other. We certainly, the observationalists certainly have not tried to silence them, and we spend a lot of time looking at the results of their models.
Actually, I guess I was having more in mind the Bush administration's attempts to silence people working within NASA itself.
Well,
and
you know, Jim Hansen was never silenced. He made it appear like he was being, but the guy has published hundreds of papers on this subject. While he's been at NASA, he was never silenced. There was some little newbie in public relations that apparently tried to do something with one of his reports, but NASA certainly did not attempt that. I chaired NASA's Science Advisory Council for 3 years up until this last October, and there was, I can guarantee you, there was no attempt to silence Jim Hansen or anybody else in NASA. And Hansen actually was pretty much off the reservation most of the time, and it's amazing that he wasn't silenced, because he certainly was not acting responsibly as an employee of NASA, I don't think. But nevertheless, he got to say what he wanted to say. The Bush administration believed that, as an administration in the White House, believed that human-caused global warming was overblown, and they said so. But the agencies under the Bush administration continued to fund research primarily on the side of modeling. So I don't think that the Bush administration, with all the mistakes that they made, and they made plenty of mistakes, this was not one of them. They were trying to be realistic about what was known about the subject. And they were worried about, as I understand it, worried about the consequences of prematurely damaging the economy in order to deal with something that was being driven purely by modeling of a very, very complex system.
Oh, sure. And I totally, you know, I would agree with your last statement there that is a definite danger. And but anyway, I know you're out of time, so I will ask no more questions. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Andrew. Dr. Schmidt, thank you for coming back on the Space Show. And I look forward to meeting you in person someday and to talking to you again.
Yeah, well, keep up the good work.
And you too, sir. Thank you very much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. And listeners, that's it. We'll be back tomorrow, Friday, with our regular Friday Space Show. John Wickham.
To make a call, press 1.
Hold on. John Wickham is with us of his space company in Casper, Wyoming. You can check it out on our newsletter, and don't miss the show. Thanks a lot, everybody. Goodbye.